A good friend of mine who is a lawyer commented once that in the difficult social questions that we have of our age, like abortion and assisted dying, that probably the bluntest social instrument that we have to manage that challenge is the law. Because laws deal in absolutes. You're either a criminal or not. You're either guilty or not after you go through whatever the legal processes are. And these are conversations that are many times far more nuanced than the law can gently capture.
As nurses, we face this decision and our attitude towards this, and I think maybe just clarifying it, that the Canadian Nurses Association, our code of ethics, gives us a conscientious objection as well. But we are not to abandon the person. So that means that somebody else can take over. But I think that bit of being there with the person throughout this, and as you point out, that we have to walk, and there's that pastoral thing of being there and listening
yes.
to the person. So
yes.
I think as nurses, it's something that we have thought through carefully as well.
I mean, I'm going to have to be honest. In the work that I've done, I've been with many, many more abortions and terminations of pregnancies than I have with physician-assisted dying. And in the case of nurses, there were many that would not want to be involved in it, but they never leave the side of the patient. Pastoral care, walking with them.
I was told that I had 3 months to live, and they admitted me to hospital immediately. Being a bit of an introvert, I didn't appreciate all the noise and chatter around me. I think it was Simone Weil who said that in silence, everything will find its emphasis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked not to have so many people coming in and out of my room. So I'm still here. And all I can say is about silence, that it was utterly delicious. And what was interesting is that there were interior uninterrupted monologues with myself, but I appreciated very much the friends where we had similar values that would come and visit. But I was very shocked one day when the nurse came in and said, "We have cut off all your phone calls." Didn't say why. And that was very painful.
I think experience also teaches us that the vast majority of us resolve our own questions and find our own answers when we're given the opportunity to talk them through, which means that probably the most useful resource that we can have to help us make decisions in our life is to have a collection of either friends or family who are constructive listeners
mm-hmm.
and who don't necessarily provide answers, but as Joanne said, just simply listen. But we're in a hugely information-driven age, which doesn't have time, a lot of the time, to wait for us to talk our way through to answers that are appropriate and authentic. So I think there's a built-in dissonance in how we've structured our institutions, our caring institutions, to kind of block out opportunities for sacred conversation around difficult matters.
Yes.
I'm just wondering what your thoughts would be about this particular scenario where a person knows, has made the decision fairly quickly that this is what they want. And they're quite fine with it. But everyone else around them is like, well, have you really thought that, they're thinking, have you really thought this through? Do you know all the implications? And you should really think this is a big decision, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just wondering about the opposite side of this, in which sometimes we can make something so complicated to the point where we confuse someone and make them consider so many different aspects of it. And it can, maybe there are times when you just have to not have the conversation and accept that somebody has made a decision and let it be. I mean, what are your thoughts on that side of the coin?
I completely agree with you. In fact, the case study that I opened, the family that were fully supportive of this man's care, that isn't a choice that they wanted for him, but they had listened to him and listened to his life and were very sure that that is where he wanted it to be. And so the best thing that they could do and that we can all do in that kind of situation is just say, tell me about it and listen. And we all know within a medical place, anytime we have diagnosis and prognosis and then possibilities of different care, there's so much information, too many choices, too many things to think about, and people can't do that. It is the same when we make choices about our own care, our own life and our own death, not to complicate it, and simply say, tell me about it, and hold what they've said. Because if you have a lot of objections and a lot of worries, that's part of what you need to go away and sort that out yourself. Because you cannot hear where the other person is. We're wanting to make the objection all the time. And to go away and sort out, well, what is that about? I'm going to miss this person. I love them. I want them near me. I don't want this relationship to end. Why don't they want to spend this last part of their life with me? We could make the quality of this life so wonderful. So, and all of those things are valid. But that conversation has to be had somewhere else.
We have a question here, and then I'll come your way.
Thank you, Joanne, for the information that you've shared. I just wanted to comment. One of the things that really stuck with me is when you talk about suspending our own beliefs, and you know, and I've done some of the work in terms of the CPE unit and PCE and worked at that, and it's really, really challenging. I think when you're having some conversations and listening to people, not for your own beliefs, to somehow on some level come into play. So it's just a comment that I think it's a real challenge.
It is a challenge.
Through these conversations to kind of put that in some place that doesn't interfere with your listening or the dialogue.
Which is why in doing that work that you're talking about, and in doing any work where you're caring for someone, you have to be very sure of your own beliefs, because when you suspend your belief to keep it out of the conversation, to push against the person, sometimes you can start questioning yourself as to your belief, as to your faith, and how you work it through. I have found that is where my need for my own community to be there to uphold me, so that I can hear others, so that I know that there's a place for me to go back and rest. And it works always that way when we listen to someone else where we get pushed like that. We need to have a place to go and have a conversation ourselves, or to be held in silence and to be with people that, yes, I know how you are feeling. I know what you're thinking. It has been the greatest gift for me to work in St. John's and to have the convent right there, because they're always praying for me. And we pray together, and everything that we do is upheld by that faith, even though what we're hearing all the time may be very different from where we're at.
If I can just add a little bit to your comment about how one's personal beliefs can be challenged, as equally challenged is the truth that we're all allowed, entitled, to make wrong decisions. Many people sometimes make decisions that aren't in the best interest for their own care, and they remain firm in their decision-making. And so you and I decide that, well, this is the wrong decision. Well, people are entitled to make what we might think are wrong decisions, and it may not be our role to persuade them otherwise.
Even our mothers.
True. Thank you very much for this conversation tonight. Currently in my family, there is a death situation occurring. And this conversation has been obviously difficult. In a recent conversation with my sister, whose husband is dying, she said to me, the hardest thing I've had to learn is that people don't want to talk about death. So, she said, that's my challenge now, because my husband doesn't want to know what's happening. On the other hand, she wants to respect his situation in himself, but how hard I find it is to recognize that with your best intentions, how do you carefully guide the truth to help that person do some things that in denial they won't want to do? But a little bit like your situation, maybe.
Sometimes people are not so much in denial about dying. It's finding the place, and we don't do this well in Western society at all, to actually use the words dying without having a sense that it's an ending, right? That because we don't, as much as we all go to church and we all repeat many things about heaven and life beyond, and we believe it, in our everyday, ordinary time around the dinner table, it's hard to make that ordinary. So that's the struggle in a family where people want to have a conversation, but they don't want to actually zero in on the dying, because it sounds to me like the conversation is wanted. This is where the hard work comes, is to make it an ordinary thing. You know, how are you feeling today? I often ask, it's one of those things that I decide to be brave about, and just actually say to someone, are you afraid to die? To that person. And I know that that's a tough one. Yes. Yes. And no, but it is a question to ask, because I have been surprised. I never have not received a response. I'll get a no, and then I wait, because that's where silence is important, and then there's why. Or I will get a yes, and it's a lot of it is that fear of nothingness. So we have to kind of draw that out. But making it ordinary, in an ordinary place, in an ordinary time, it's kind of like the big sex talk. It's you want to do it in just somewhere ordinary and in an ordinary way. But, and we need to work harder at making death, because that's what it is. Absolutely.
I think is a good example of that, which is something that continues to frustrate me after all my years of end-of-life care in my chaplaincy ministries. the words we use to talk about death in today's society are past, passed on, or lost. Oh, we lost Dad last month. I always go, oh, what, in the park? On vacation or something? And I always try to bring language that is dealing with it with honesty into the conversation. I found much to my surprise that my mother actually enjoys talking with me about her dying. I found out that I'm the only one that she feels comfortable talking about because all of her other children don't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But at least she's got somebody that she can talk about it. We laugh a lot about it too. So
I understand and embrace the decision of the family. I'm not sure whether that was a real case or...
It was, yes. I was the chaplain called in to do something.
It's difficult for me to talk about this because I lost my wife just over 2 years ago. But one thing that disturbed me about that case is the fact that he felt he had been cursed. And I just wonder if you could elaborate on that a bit, because perhaps, too, you could touch a bit on... I was so shocked when the palliative care doctor said that there was no use continuing to feed my wife. You put it that way. She was much more sensitive than that.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we do to educate people to understand? That's a natural part of the dying process, but I didn't know about that.
No,
so there's two questions. Was that issue dealt with?
The demon part?
In that case, because I don't feel anybody should die feeling that they've been cursed. I don't like that at all.
So,
although I embraced the decision.
Yes. This patient had a psychiatrist working that through, but honestly, my experience when it comes to demons or anything like that where we enter into the supernatural world, God included, psychiatry tends to want to move away. So that's when I get called in. So I can tell you that that's what we talked about, he and I. Was the cursing by this neighbor, what the neighbor was like. Because one of the rules that I follow, whether I might be diagnosed as a psychosis or not, that's real. That demon is real, and that curse is real. So how do you experience that? Tell me about the neighbor, what happened. So he was able to tell that story. It didn't remove it, but that was important to him, and it was real. And the reason I remember that conversation clearly was because I was with the staff doctor when I went into the room, and that's where we started, and the staff doctor took one look at me and left. I think he wasn't quite sure. But then, you know, he did come to me afterwards and say, I'm thankful that you did that. I think that that's the kind of conversation that he needed to have. That's within palliative care when they reach that decision that, and I'm hoping that they didn't really use that word. Yes, yes. There reaches a point for people when they're in the dying process where their body just can't take that food in. Just can't. In fact, by taking the food in, trying to digest it and go through, that's more painful for them and more harmful for them than not feeding them. And it allows, because, you know, if people weren't in hospital and they were at home, they would not, families years ago would just have fed little bits and given people what they could manage. There was no such thing as tubes. You couldn't do that. And the body takes over and dies in the natural way, and that's what palliative care aims to do, to help people as much as possible without pain. So we do have that added piece, without pain, to die in a natural way so you don't feel all that pain.
Thank you so much for teaching us about what the people thought about the die. Thank you so much. But we have to learn more and more and read the Bible is the best way to teach ourselves. But thank you that tonight I put all my listening to the what is playing very careful, you know, the people. But I want to read in John 3:16, it says, God, he loves so much, you know, the world, but he gives his only begotten son, what, however, believe in him, because is nothing perish, but have eternal life. Mm-hmm. Nothing is eternal. You know, this is what I try to say. Thank you for us, encourage to the us.
Thank you. Yes. He's coming.
Well, I was told I didn't have to run anymore.
I'm wondering what you think of the concept of the death dinner. I'm sure you've heard of it. If you Google it, it's, you know, suggesting that we embark upon gatherings, social gatherings with family members and friends specifically for the purpose of talking about death. Do you think that could make a meaningful contribution to these kinds of conversations?
So you asked me what I personally think. So I'm going to answer what I think that we're wonderful. I think that that is just a wonderful thing to do. But it's that takes a lot of bravery on the part of everyone around the table to be able to listen to each person. It also takes a lot of bravery to bring all of your emotions into that space and not leave them behind and kind of come and try to be separate. So they'd have to be done with great care if you want to actually get something from them. But I think as a chaplain who's been doing this for quite a long while, we would love it. I would love to have a group of chaplains come together and talk about it. In fact, my colleagues at Mount Sinai and I, that's something that we talked about having and hosting.
There's also another version of that's taking place. There's an Anglican parish down in Nova Scotia that's been written up in their version of the Anglican of death cafes.
Yes.
Where people come together on a monthly basis or maybe 3 or 4 times a year over coffee and have conversations around various dimensions and topic matters related to their own dying and dying in general, and social trends and so on and so forth.
There's an artist, and I actually have one of the pieces of her work, and all her art is the how did I die? And like many people, she loves to walk around cemeteries, graveyards, and to take in the stories and see. And she realized that when every time she stopped, she was seeing a story in front of her of somebody's life and death. And she took to painting that and would sell them. And they're powerful. And for her, that's how she touched on how she feels about dying and where she thinks we go when we die. She's Christian, but what that looks like for her and what safety that provides for her.